Well, we've been very fortunate to have had the support systems that the National No-Till Group has had over the years. And it's been one of the real fringe benefits of our journey has been the relationship with Mike and his dad. And there's nothing more fun than being on a combine all day long and having people like that come out where you get dad for a while and you get his perspectives on succession, and then you get the son and you get his perspectives, and then you put them together. And that story's always exactly the same, right? Ha ha. All right. Just a quick background so that you can put the things I'm going to talk about in perspective. Out of grad school, I spent 8 years with Farm Credit traveling over the U.S., where I got to see lots of farms and ranches and who were succeeding and who was failing and what are some of the processes that people that are in the success column are making them successful. I had a chance to go back to the farm in 1980 where I was manager of that business until 2 years ago, and our daughter took over as CEO. So I'm now board chairman and transition coach, which means I don't make any decisions and I don't make any plans. It is the ultimate dream job. Over that journey the last 38 years, I've also done family business consulting on financial management, transition planning, conflict management. So it's kind of been a dream career to run a farm and also do consulting. And the old saying, those who can do, those who can't teach, and those who can't do either one, consult. Oh, I do all three, so you can kind of pick and choose which category you want to criticize me. And I've also been on a number of boards. One of the most enjoyable during this journey was in 2000 when we formed the Pacific Northwest Direct Seed Association. Our families had a long-term commitment to conservation and better farming practices, and that organization helped us really jumpstart the final step to what I consider the best way to farm. I've been on the faculty at TPAP for years. I just got back from Austin last night, so I've been in front of the podium for 4 straight days and 3 nights of the bear pit, so I'm almost out of voice. But how fun is it to be in a room full of highly motivated farmers who are trying to be the best of the best? So I'll give you a quick IQ test. What do these things have to do with process improvement? A tractor rolls over because it had a flat tire the day before, and when they fixed the tire, they didn't put the fluid back in, and they were in a hurry to go spray some weeds. So they took the roll bar off to clean out the manure in a barn and didn't put the roll bar back on and went out and sprayed on a steep hillside. Tractor rolled over. The driver was nearly killed, broke 14 ribs, punctured 4 out of 5 lobes in his lungs, broke his jaw and his shoulder. That was my cousin, by the way. Skidder operators operating a skidder on a steep slope and ends up losing control, goes down the slope 500 feet, no seat belt, and was killed. OSHA shows up the next day, and this family has not had an accident in 60 years. What do you suppose they went through that day going with OSHA? Employee gets caught spraying ineligible chemical near a creek. A grandpa in Saskatchewan takes his grandson to the shop. We're gonna go play today. Puts him up in the cab, says, don't touch anything. Starts working under the combine, and the kid hit a button and it killed his grandfather. Fuel spills because an employee was filling an implement with an auto shutoff left the scene. How often does a fuel shutoff that's automatic work? All the time when you're watching it, right? When is the one time it doesn't work? When you walk away, okay? Employee is talking on his cell phone while he wings out his self-propelled sprayer, hits some power lines, and blows all 4 tires off the tractor. You ought to see the picture of that one. That's pretty cool. An employee is talking on his cell phone and tips a logging truck over on a steep grade. Fortunately, he tipped it into the ditch instead of off to the other side where it's 1,000 feet down to the bottom of the canyon. So what do these have to do with process improvement? When you have no clearly defined culture for documenting and following SOPs, auditing your process and rewarding and incentivizing improvements, bad things happen. So think about for a second, what are some things in your business that it would be helpful to to have them better document in the form of a standard operating procedure? Who can just throw out some ideas? In your operation, where are some areas where it would be helpful to have more things written down?
Hitch pins.
Hitch pins. Proper use of hitch pins. Okay?
Switching the planter from corn to beans.
Switching an implement from one commodity to another. Over here. Anybody have grain bins? Do you have clearly defined SOPs on entry and cleaning out bins, or somebody's going to crawl on the top?
No.
Should you?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Header changeovers.
Header changeovers, okay. Yes. Pardon me? Starting a tractor. Yeah, these new tractors, it takes a manual to figure out how to get them turned on, right? And once you get them turned on, how do you get them to move? Anything else? Maintenance, simple oil change. Okay? We can think of lots of things that it would be more helpful to have the process written down so that there's consistency and efficiency. So let's walk through a sample case study where we're looking at efficiency on our farm and we're running a series of semis where we have to go through a port of entry. So if we're overloaded, we get what? We get a fine. So to be conservative and avoid the fines, we tend to underload because we don't know how heavy we are. And let's say you analyzed all the tickets on a series of trucks over a period of a week, and on average you're under by 40 bushels what you could haul. Is that inefficient? Is that extra 40 bushels going to cost you more to haul to town? Not really. So if you added that all up, you have just wasted $11,000 of cost over the course of a harvest. So if we were to put a wagon scale on our grain wagon, $3,200, $1,500 to install, how quickly do we get that money back? In half a season, we have just paid for that waste. We put that scale on our wagon several years ago, and what was the other benefit we got from that, having that scale? Calibrating the combines. What else?
Yield.
No? What is the worst stress in the world if you're a driver and you're going towards a port? You're wondering if you're going to be over, right? We just eliminate that stress. So quality of life, reduction of stress is something that's really valuable. So this is just one simple example of how we can apply the concept of process improvement. So what we're going to do this morning is help you understand what the term means. How do we create motivation and reach for excellence? How do we create consequences when you're lax? And we'll look at a number of applications and case studies where people have applied this. This is a 100-year-old science. It was first started by Frederick Taylor, and then it got a lot more notoriety by Frank Gilbert, who was he was in the movie Cheaper by the Dozens, and that's when people got to really know him. How many have ever seen that movie, Cheaper by the Dozens? Even some young folks here. So I learned my first process improvement lesson from my parents when I was about 8 years old. And we had this TV that was, hot tubes in it back in about the late 50s. And Mom and Dad were going out on a date. And they said, you kids make sure you're in bed by 9 o'clock. So at 8 o'clock, we were watching TV and this movie came on and it was fascinating. Frank Gilbert had 12 kids and he would blow the whistle and see how many seconds it took for all these kids to race outside and line up. And 9 o'clock comes along and we're only halfway through the movie. So we put half the kids on guard to watch out the window for headlights and the rest of us watched the movie. And so we got to 10 o'clock, no headlights, thank goodness. We turned the TV off, went to bed. Next morning, Mom, Dad, breakfast. Did you kids enjoy the movie? We thought, how did they know? Well, the TV was right by the front door, and when they walked in, they put their hand on the TV, and it was still hot at 11 o'clock. So they were pretty certain that we didn't go to bed at 9 o'clock. So that was their process. So modern days, we have lots of books and things that are talking about process improvement. things like Six Sigma, Total Quality Management, Business Process Design, but they're all just buzzwords for how do you decide what to manage and measure. One of the first big studies that showed potential for improvement was a pig iron study where they analyzed the build and the talent of various workers and rearranged who got assigned to what jobs. And they found that with some putting some science into this, they could go from 12 tons to 47 tons a day of steel handled by one person. 400% increase in productivity. They were able to pay people more when they're more efficient, and they cut their cost of production by 56%. So we thought, we're on to something here. Frank Gilbreth's deal was on bricks. How do you help bricklayers be more efficient? Our son's an architect in Seattle, and when I was working on this presentation several years ago, I asked him, how could I quantify the savings today of the process improvement principles that Frank put together? And he had designed a new science building for one of the universities there in Seattle, and they had 800,000 bricks. The total cost savings of implementing the principles that he had designed lowered this cost by 43%, and it enabled people to do the job in half the time, 49% of the time that it would take them before. So how did they do this? They examined pallets full of bricks and went, what if I pre-sort these bricks and take all the bad ones out of here? I'll look at each brick and see which of the way the brick should be to be right side up so that when the bricklayer gets there, where can I place the brick so he's not running for bricks? And they came up with the first invention of scaffolds, and they put the bricks up on the scaffold so that the guy turned, grabbed the brick, put it in place. And they looked at every movement, every step they made and said, how can we make this more efficient? Now, are you following me? Are you thinking about your farm? What are things you're doing every day where if you thought like this, you could totally change your efficiency in your process? So let's look at some of these areas where this has been applied. I have a really good friend who has a series of restaurants in Lewiston, Idaho, and he's a process improvement freak. He pulled up to his taco tie one day, and he ordered a taco at the window. And then he watched how many seconds it took to get his order. Then he went in the front door and he said, it took this long to get my taco. I'll give you a dollar. If I give you a dollar, how many seconds do you think you can shave off of that time? Made it a contest. So he drove back around, made the order, and they shaved several seconds off. Then he went back in and he did it again. And he did it three times. And each time, they shaved time off. Because they were starting to think now about what is the fastest way that I can get this job done. And he got so excited about this, he hired a professional time and management company to come in and study everything that happened in his business. The delivery, where do they bring the stuff in? Where is the food and the ingredients placed so that it could maximize the speed and efficiency of his staff? And then they developed a whole new set of SOPs on how to make tacos. In the ultimate results, Cinco de Mayo, every year, they have a big deal on tacos. After employing the principles that they went through, they went from 15,000 to 31,000 tacos in one day. That's a lot of belly aches, right? So who else is applying this? The dairy industry, how many of you have ever seen a robotic milker? These things are incredible. And one robotic milker basically could handle 50 to 60 cows, and they don't get sick, they don't have an attitude, they remember each cow's unique characteristics, how much foreplay they need before they're milked. It's incredible how much efficiency is improved with these milking robots. We have gains in almost every aspect of agriculture and in timber as well. I'm going to just walk through some of these really quickly. Several years ago, the Pacific Northwest, a bunch of growers had a case study where we had 30 growers trying to implement direct seeding who were trying to figure out, are we actually making progress financially? So we looked several years of working together. We kind of perfected which drills worked best. Then we started perfecting what nutrient management worked best. But everybody was in that category of, Is it better financially? If it's just making this better environmentally, but we're not improving ourselves bottom line, is it really worth it? And when we went through a before and after process, that group on average went from a 4% return on equity to a 23% return on equity. And a lot of it was because they're employing substantial process improvement along the way. We have timber in our operation, and this is an area where there's been massive improvement and gains. The olden days, we used to skid things with a logger, or with a dozer or a skidder. Nowadays, we have Faller bunchers and stroker delimbers that basically, on a good day, I could make 2 to 3 loads of logs the old way. These guys can make 9 to 10 loads a day at a lower cost than I can hand log. It's incredible how quickly we can kick. We logged 100 acres this summer and took over 1 million board feet off a 100-acre stand. And basically, I did a little bit of cleanup with a skidder, but that was it. So if you look at your farm and say, where was I 40 years ago? And where am I today? You would probably see a picture somewhat like this. 40 years ago, we had 6 partners, 2,500 acres of crop ground. We ran 4 combines, 6 trucks, and we were working ground about 6 to 8 times a year. Today, on 20,000 acres, we're 100% direct seeded. Our efficiency is unbelievable. One combine today is the equivalent of 6 to 8 combines in 1980. I went back to the farm in 1980 and immediately said, you're the sprayer guy now. And we had an old John Deere combine that was converted to a sprayer, and it went 4 miles an hour on average. And going up a hill, it was 3, and down a hill, it was 8. And it didn't have a monitor, so guess what our application rates were? All over the board, right? And then we got a Dickey John computer, and we're starting to understand what precision application went. But today, that 120-foot sprayer can spray 800 to 900 acres a day. Many of you in the Midwest can spray your whole farm in 2 days with a sprayer. And so technology has done what? It's forced us to get bigger or to figure out how to spread these costs over more acres or share equipment or do something else, because it doesn't take all year to get our work done. So what is process improvement? In essence, it's identifying jobs that are repetitive, documenting how they're supposed to be performed with an SOP or a good agricultural practice, evaluating how to do it better. And what is better? It's more efficient, safer, more economical, and environmentally sustainable. And then we don't stop there. We have to have a system for auditing and rewarding gains. So where are the areas in your business where we could apply this? We start out by looking at what is an SOP. An SOP is basically a guidance document for routine or repetitious jobs. And these are useful for training, for leveraging communication with multiple employees, helps to assure that jobs are done the way we want them done. It helps to increase safety and lowers cost of production. It's also a basis for performance evaluations. And lastly, sometimes we have to do this to access value-added markets. Somebody says, you're going to get more money for your product. I want to know how you do it, not just what you do. What happens when we don't follow SOPs? Bad things. We get inconsistent work, accidents, inefficiency. We can have food safety hazards, market demand destruction, or excess turnover. This guy was on his cell phone one day, driving down the road, didn't see how narrow the bridge was, and tipped the combine over. So let's start out with, in your office, this is the first place that many people have started to employ SOPs. Many years ago, our oldest daughter, Hannah, was starting to get old enough that she could help me in the office. And so I think she was 12 or 13. I said, I'd like to pay bills and learn how to kind of help me. And she goes, great. So by the time she graduated from high school, she was doing all my bill paying, lease renewals, marketing. And on graduation night, most parents are crying because they're in stress about their children leaving home. And I'm sitting there doing what? I'm crying because I just realized my office manager's leaving and I have no idea how to do this stuff anymore. None of this stuff was written down. It was all in her head. So how did you do those 1099s? How did you do those W-2s? How did you do that backup system? I got so used to her doing it that it became no longer something secondhand. And so, what happened here? What if you looked at all these areas, and imagine that your office manager ran off with the hired man and your backup system fried? Just think about some of the worst things that could happen here. Where would you be as a business? You would be up a creek, wouldn't you? So this is an area that has probably been the first to have documentation, because most of you are not farming because you like to keep books or manage people, are you? You're farming because you like to grow stuff. And this is the stuff you have to do. So things you have to do and you don't do very often, what's the best way to do them well? You document how you did it so that the next time you have to do it, you have some documentation. Equipment, operations, and servicing. These are things that you're more probably comfortable with. Where can we do a better job with good maintenance checklists, operating instructions, shop protocols, workflow, harvest crew orientation, and grain storage? We'll walk through some examples of ways that these have been professionalized. How many of you run big semis? Most of you in the room. So we run 7 semis, and they all have to go through a port of entry to get to our delivery point. So we cannot afford to have a truck shut down in the port during harvest, can we? My brother was a really good mechanic, and one year he thought, the best checklist in the world is probably the one the port's using, so he went down to the port and followed the inspector around as they did an inspection on our trucks and developed a checklist. And we end up with about a 3-page checklist of things that you need to check on these trucks. Now every year, before those trucks go out, they go completely through an audit and a check, and the employees go through the things that they understand, and the things that are not checked, that are over their head, they hand back to the service manager, and somebody, we make sure, has reviewed every single thing on this checklist. That has changed us from a reactive find the problem while you're in the field to a proactive get the problems diagnosed during the off season, and when it's time to harvest, rarely do we have a major problem. How many of you have service trucks in your business? So it's 100 degrees, you're out there harvesting, and you blow an O-ring on your hydraulic system, and you're already hot and you're upset. And when you go to put the hydraulic fluid back in, what's the only jug in the service truck that's empty? The hydraulic oil, right? Or you blow a water line and you go to get the antifreeze, and it's the only one that's empty. So how many of you have an SOP for all the things that should be stocked in your service truck, and somebody clearly assigned every morning to make sure that all those things are in there? How many of us should have this? Raise your hands. Come on, humor me. I know it's early in the morning, okay? Yeah, I know you should have this. Okay? Yeah, and I've been there and if you're already mad about having to fix something and you got oil all over yourself, how really mad are you when you find out there's no fluid in that jug? It's not a way to enhance people's attitudes during harvest. Fuel supply is another area where we probably should have some more rigorous procedures. We talked about filling. We have an SOP that says you never put a fuel hose in a piece of equipment without staying there till it's done. Even if you have a spill prevention in the pad where you can collect your mess, it's just not worth the risk. The few seconds or few minutes that you might save, is it really worth it? How many of you have an SPCC plan? This is a plan that you have to be able to take bulk delivery on the farm. It's been mandated by OSHA. A lot of farmers know they should do this. They've been avoiding it, hoping that OSHA will go away. I doubt this is going to go away. Our philosophy has always been, when you have something that comes out like this, if it's apparent that it's going to be enforced, do it early, when you can have some say in it, and probably the engineering costs are going to be lower, because the longer you wait, probably the more it's going to cost. And That cost $15,000 to bring that fuel system up to par. It didn't add a single cent to our bottom line, but it allowed us to keep getting bulk diesel. About 3 years after we did this, there was some kind of a rule passed where the co-ops sent everybody a letter and said, we cannot deliver to you bulk fuel unless you have your plan, because if we do, then we'll get fined. So they figured out, if I can't get the farmer, I'm going to get to him through the supplier. So guess what? A lot of people were having to buy fuel one tank at a time in town until they could get under compliance. And what do you think that cost them? It doesn't take long to run up a $15,000 bill buying fuel in a non-wholesale manner. Safety is probably one of the most important things that we're going to talk about today. We, as farmers and ranchers, have a lot of moving parts, right? And there's potential for safety problems everywhere we look. PTOs, conveyors, hoists, grain bins, people riding on machinery, equipment rollovers, cargo strapping. I'll just tell you a few stories in this list. Had a neighbor who was hauling scrap iron, and he used a nylon strap to strap a big steel box on his truck. That strap cut in two on that box, and the box flew off, hit a van, killed a family of people. Had a client who had kids. They had a daughter-in-law who had an attitude. Her belief was, since I have the right last name, I have special rights. And she would take the company really best truck in harvest and take an hour break, go home, read her book. Her sons had an attitude because they had the right last name. They would go on to the lot where they were delivering potatoes, and they would jump in the ATVs and race them around the tracks and then climb up and down the conveyors. And the foreman would say, you can't do that. It's unsafe. It's against company policy. And you know what the kid said? Looked at this foreman, he said, my last name is X, and I can fire you just like that. Do we have a problem here? We have a couple problems. And one safety, and one is a family business succession problem. So every one of these topics has got bad stories that many of you could probably share as well as I could. I have a really good friend who's a neighbor, who a former Navy SEAL. After he got out of the Navy, he went to work for the state of Idaho in the workman's comp division. And he does safety training and preventive training on how to avoid safety incidents. And there's some interesting statistics from his experiences. For every dollar in insurance claims, an employer spends $4 to $5. He spent a lot of time talking about how do we create better incentives for thinking proactively in the workplace, and how those things can affect insurance modifications. So what is this picture here? Anybody recognize that? Boy, you guys are flunking badly. I know you have these. You're just telling me you don't use it. This is the battery cutout switch on your combine or your tractor. Almost all of you have newer equipment that has this. So if that grandpa in Saskatchewan had simply walked over and flipped that thing 90 degrees before he put his son in the cab, would he be alive today? Absolutely. But we're farmers, we're in a hurry, we're trying to be efficient. We know that those things are there, but we just don't want to take that 5 seconds sometimes to do something that would be guarantee that nobody could hurt. How many of us are working on combines during the summer where the header's up in the air and somebody's working in the cab and you haven't turned this thing off? All it takes is one accident. And so if you have a clearly defined SOP that says no one gets off a piece of machinery and works on it, especially underneath it, without turning the cutoff switch, could that save lives? Absolutely. This is a little triangle that's very revealing. For every 600 near misses or close calls, there's 30 damages, 10 injuries, and one disability or death. So think about this. How many warnings do we get before somebody dies? 600 warnings. So how many opportunities do we get to figure out how to do it better or to avoid that death? 600 learning opportunities. Now, I said that as a positive statement. If we say there are 600 learning opportunities, as opposed to we got away with it 600 times before somebody died. Is that a different way of looking at it? And what do we tend to do? We got away with it. Nobody saw it. Thank goodness. And we go and do it again, right? So that's human nature. But we need to change that culture in our businesses to how do we make near misses and close calls a learning opportunity to avoid the chance of a death. Mike Malone was an astronaut that wrote the book Predictable Surprises. Anybody read that book? Great, Mike. It's a fantastic book. He keynoted the top producer conference several years ago, and I thought, this guy's got the perfect book on process improvement. And it's hilarious. It's a humorous book as well. But he has several good points. Success is doing things well over and over consistently. And when he described his process for success, there's several things that you can probably relate to. Beware of normalization of deviance. That's the human tendency to deviate from a standard. If somebody said this is the way it should be done, we just by nature go, I think I could do it a different way and get the job done just fine. Beware of false feedback. This is the absence of something bad happening. So, you're hauling Caterpillar tractors on low boys. You're fairly level country. We're in a hurry. Let's just run it up on there and drive down the road. We don't need to put a chain on there. We didn't put a chain on last time. It'll be fine. How many times do you do that before you realize, I should have had a chain on it every time because sooner or later that thing's going to slide off there, right? And the more times that we get away with something, the more times we start to think that it's okay to do something dangerous. This last one relates to that triangle. Archive, review, and learn from our near misses and disasters. How many of you have grain bins here? When you look at the statistics on grain bin deaths and all the articles that are written on these things, you wonder how in the world somebody can die in a bin today by jumping in the top of a bin without a harness and without an observer. But annually, how often does it happen? One of my first clients 30-some years ago was a father, a very progressive farmer in South Dakota that jumped in a crusted corn bin. And it crust broke and he fell down in there. As they were loading into a semi, it sucked him into the cone and he died from asphyxiation. So many of us have probably experienced a friend or a relative or this has happened. And you look at these statistics from Purdue and it looked like we were making progress was we got from 60 to 20 in 2012, but then we almost doubled by 14. So how can we be having 23 to 25 deaths a year from these kind of incidences? So having SOPs for how to store it, how to entry, go in and out of these things, buddy systems, rules for riding on grain boxes and implements. Would you all agree this is an important area to have codified? Absolutely. What's your cell phone policy? How many of you have a written cell phone policy? So what's your policy say? Okay. You can't talk on the phone and drive. Can you have your phone in your possession at work?
Yes.
Okay. And why do you allow that?
Personal calls.
Okay.
Plus we use it sometimes for communication.
Okay. Makes sense. Exactly the same as ours. How many of you have seen situations where that talking on a phone has endangered that employee's life or endangered some of your equipment? So what are you waiting for? This to me is a no-brainer. It's a simple thing. And you're probably going, yeah, but that requires work and it's going to be take me a bunch of time to do this. So how many millennials do we have in the room? If you want to admit it. Come on. I know you get a bad rap, but just by the way, you millennials are off the hook now because we have the Z generation, so we can pick on them, so you're no longer the focus of being picked on. So, Miss Millennial, how would you write a cell phone policy efficiently? Oh my gosh, she plunked. You hit Google, right? Cell phone policy, and how many answers will you get in about 10 seconds? Like 100,000 samples. So many years ago, I was working with the client and they wanted an example of a really good family business employment policy. And I had been working a lot in this area and helping people understand how do you set up ground rules for who gets to come into the business. But I didn't have a really good one I could show her. So I pretended to be a millennial and I Googled family employment policy. And it came up 100,000 responses. And the first six, Google sorts stuff for quality. And the first six were fantastic. It was incredible. The content that was there, I took the key ideas, made an outline, and it didn't spend more than an hour, and I had a first-class piece of documentation. So this whole, I'm using this to illustrate that everything we're talking about today does not take a lot of time. Somebody has probably done it, or it's out there on the web, where you can take templates or samples, and very quickly, so on a cell phone policy, if you wanted to have one in your business, I bet with a half hour's work, you could pull up some samples, schedule a staff meeting and say, okay, what should be our policy? And here are some different ways that people have handled this. And do you think you could come to a consensus? I'm pretty sure you can. So, yes?
Just a quick comment. You're not asking the hard question, though. On this cell phone policy, of all of us sitting in this room, even if you have that policy, are the managers and owners adhering to that policy?
We're going to get to that. Key point. It doesn't do any good to have it if there's not a commitment from the top and there's not a 100% culture of zero tolerance for noncompliance, right? And we'll come to that in a little bit. So, to your point, our son's in his architectural work, he's often on site watching these projects, and he had a contractor that has a very rigid safety policy. And they have a zero tolerance. You have to have your warning jacket on, your hard hat, and your little red safety book that has the company SOPs on safety in your pocket. And if you're caught on site at any time with any of those missing, it's immediate dismissal. So he was on a job one day, and one of the workers was there, and he didn't have one of those three items. I think it was the little red book in his pocket. And he was a longer-term employee, a really valuable employee, and he was fired on the spot. Does that surprise you? What was the message there? The message was, we care about your safety, and we have made it very clear to all of you that you must do these three things, and we cannot tolerate anybody making an exception to this. And as much as that employer probably hated to lose that guy, it was more important for him to send that message to employees about their welfare and safety than to keep this one employee. And what do you think about the rest of that crew from there on? Following policy. There was no question that you show up with these things. And it's a buddy system if anybody's starting to step out of line. So think about your operation. Are you a farm or a business or are you a playground? How do we rethink the process of having kids ride on tractors or ride in trucks or ride in the back of a grain box? I do this. You know, I love to take my grandkids on a tractor when I feed. But are we really thinking every second about, is this the safest way to do this? I think we oftentimes put that secondary to having fun and giving these folks an experience on the farm. As I said earlier, doing this stuff doesn't have to be hard. There's all kinds of great templates out here where if you want to have a formal safety policy for your business, you can download these things and they're I was teaching at TPAP, and I do a longer version of this same segment down there. And in the break, one of the guys already had downloaded this on his iPhone. He said, this is really cool. It's got checklists that you can build and modify for your own farm business. This middle one has all the areas of a potential farm that could have hazards and has sample checklists to set up safety policies. So it has grain bins, shops, equipment, manure pits, just about anything that you could have in an ag operation. Are these presentations all online, Mike?
They will be.
Okay, so everything you're seeing here you can download as a PDF, so those of you who are wanting to take notes, you don't have to worry about that. So what are some areas in the process improvement that apply to agronomy? Nutrient management, pest management, conservation, documenting inputs, precision farming have all been areas that have lend themselves to better SOPs. How many of you do precision ag and write prescriptions for your fields? A lot of you. So we started seriously getting into precision ag in 2000. We were mapping, we were really trying to interpret these things and trying to do variable rate, and we were hiring an outside consultant to interpret our data and write prescriptions. So how many of you do that? Quite a few of you. So when did you get your prescription from your consultant? About 5 seconds before you're ready to go, right? And I was fed up with this because we were giving them the data with ample lead time for them to analyze it, but no matter how soon we gave them the stuff, we would always get this thing on an email about 5 seconds, or sometimes 5 seconds after we were loaded and we were ready to go. And I finally said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I will pay you whatever it takes to sit down with me and teach me how to do this so that we can do this on our own time and put our own personal interpretations into it. And so he said, okay, that's the best way to do it anyway. So they came up, sat down with me, and they went through our software and pulled the stuff up and showed me how to write prescriptions. And I was, every move they made, every keystroke, I documented, and I had 5-page SOP when I got done. So when we got done, I said, we had 66 fields to do. I said, how many times will I have to do this before I can do it without looking at the SOP? And he said, 60 times. He was right on. By the 60th time, I could go through the whole set of steps and not check something. So I was pretty proud of myself, and then the next season came along and I thought, well, I should be able to jump right in and do it. Well, I jumped in there, and after 6 months, my 5 pages didn't have as much clarity as I thought, because there were some things that I assumed I would know that were pretty simple I didn't write down, and I had to call and go, how did you get from that step to this step? And so they're a little bit longer and they're a little more thoughtful. Yes. You can make them too complicated or not. It's a judgment call, but you start with what is enough, and then you refine them. These are never done. So we just kept refining these, and so I'll finish this story. We've been in a transition process for several years where I've been bringing the next generation on board to do this stuff. And their biggest fear when we were seeding is if I was off in one of these speaking things and they didn't have all their prescription files because they didn't know how to do it. And I don't want that. So I said, you can do this. And so I sat down, taught them how to follow the SOP. And these SOPs that were clear as mud to me were not clear as mud to them. So we had another round of reviewing them, going step by step. So words that meant something to me didn't mean the same to them. But the point of this is there was a structure, and it was easy to enhance it, and within a little bit of time, they put the words that made sense to them in there, and now two other people on the farm can go on that computer and write a prescription for any field in the farm. And there's still red and ink changes. Every time somebody does it, somebody adds a refinement and periodically update the file. But we're looking at saving thousands of dollars a year, plus our agronomy consultant said, you know your fields better than anybody. I'm just looking at data. But you know things about your fields that data is never going to show me, and I think you can do a better job. How many would you agree with that? I think that's the truth. So don't be afraid to tackle this. Don't be afraid to have someone coach you on the SOP to do this. How many have livestock in the room? Several of you. So there's a number of areas in livestock where we can benefit from SOPs in stock handling, herd health. My nephew's the cattle manager in our operation, and he developed this herd health program several years ago. And I challenged him to develop this because he had a herdsman working under him that was new, and he was stressed about he never followed his instructions. And my nephew suffers from not giving the clearest of instructions. So I said, why don't you sit down and develop everything you typically do with this herd over a 12-month period, the cattle, the calves, the bulls, the horses. And he did a brilliant job of laying out by month for each category what the action is, the purpose, and the products we use. So once he did, I said, this is really cool. Have you showed this to vet? No. why don't you go down and review this with the vet and see what they think? And they went through and they said, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. But they started reading it and they said, how come you're doing this in here and this? He said, because you told me to. Well, if I had known you're doing that back there, I wouldn't have told you to do this. What do we learn from this? You as farmers are managing a cropping management system, right? Or as livestock people, you have a systems process. If somebody doesn't know your system, they're just going to give you advice on a transaction one at a time. But if they see your system and we can enhance or improve the system, you could save money, you can end up with a better bottom line. And so one of the real values of SOPs is challenging your system and seeing that there's a better way to do it. Anybody ship cattle a feedlot? Do you know that if you don't have a processing map and document what you've already given these cattle, what happens when they hit the other end? They get the same stuff again. So consumers are very much concerned about overuse of antibiotics. We can eliminate a lot of that by good SOPs for what is put on these animals. We never ship a load of cattle to a feedlot without this map going along with the brand inspection and the health papers. And if you're feeding the cattle yourself, you're saving yourself money. But if you're selling into another market, you're also not providing an opportunity for somebody to over-inject cattle if they don't need it. Lots of public attention to stock handling. We've had numerous issues in the press about downer cows or mishandling of chickens. We need to all have an SOP in our business for how livestock are supposed to be handled, an animal care statement, and what is your beef, your quality assurance program. These are just examples in each of these areas where there's already good SOPs that you can download and build on. Food safety is kind of the next category. Back up, just I don't want to spend much time on there, but if you're in the vegetable industry, you cannot sell a product unless you have SOPs and a good agricultural practice binder for your business. Grain farmers have been lucky. They have not been put under the same scope, but sooner or later, many of you will be put under more rigorous requirements to be able to access your markets. Another dimension of process improvement is analyzing variances. The academic term for this is statistical process control and influence. Mike Bolgi from Purdue pointed this out to me one day, and I said, that's an awful big phrase for variance analysis. But what we're trying to do when we're looking at variances, let's say you have a sprayer and you're trying to determine what your target rate is and why your actual rate is way off. What's the cause? Is it an out of bounds? Is it a normal deviation? Or is it an out of bounds, which means we have a procedural or a systems process weakness? And what's the impact when we have a variance? We can have cost overruns, crop damage, we can have quality damage, or any combination of the above. So let's take this sample of the sprayer. One of the reasons that we put our sprayers in the shop and we run our nozzles through a nozzle tester every winter is those things get worn out, right? So if we're out in the field and we just ran a load out and we were supposed to get 100 acres and we only got 90 acres, what's the problem? Is it my flow meter? Are my nozzles worn out? There's something else wrong. But what's the cost of having a 5 or 10% overrun in a sprayer? It's huge, isn't it? So in this day and age where many of us are farming at break even, having clear SOPs for equipment and maintenance, and particularly how these sprayers are gone through, can actually be a high rate of return to your business. I'm going to flip to the soft side of your business, and we're just about ready to wrap up here. When you look at human resource management, this is an area that is sorely lacking in agriculture. Like I said earlier, we farm because we like to grow stuff, not manage people and finances. So how many of you have written job descriptions, organization charts, safety guidelines, performance reviews, a clearly defined compensation policy and payroll procedures, and everything here wrapped up in a nice employee handbook? Just raise your hands. How many have that all in place? How many would like to raise your hand and say, I have that in place? We all need this. And you are not just running a farm, you're running a farm business. And many of you are running huge farm businesses. where you know you should have this, but it's something not fun, and so you just get by. But we have uncertainty, we have inefficiency, where this, a lot of this could be eliminated if these are clearly defined. In the area of policy, I call these the landmines in a family business. These are the things that if you don't have a written policy and consensus in your team, it's what kills family businesses. It's where we fight. How do you handle housing, insurance, room and board, setting compensation? Who gets to put money into the business? Once it's in, what are the ground rules for who gets to take it out? This family employment policy is one of the hottest topics right now in succession planning. If you have multiple siblings working together and there's potential cousins that could come into this business in the future, is there a clearly defined path for how they are even considered for employment? Is there a requirement for apprenticeships? Do they have to have a fit with your vision and values? There's some key things that I think you believe, but if you don't commit that to paper, the wrong candidate shows up and say, no, you're not employable. And they say what? Well, based on what? So having this in place, policy before the need is should be the ground rule in your business. How many of you have a documented organization chart that shows who are the key players and who reports to whom? In our succession planning workshops, we'll have people, husband and wife teams that have been working together for 50 years, we'll ask them to put down on paper their organization chart. And the rule is you can't look at each other's paper. So they're sitting there, they're scribbling these charts out, and the wife's looking over the husband's shoulder going, that's not the way it is. And they've been sleeping together for 50 years. So if they can't agree, imagine how confused the employees are. And this is not rocket science. There are people that run various divisions of any farm business, whether it's a shop or the crops or the livestock. Someone's in charge. Typically, a group of these people are the owners that work as an owner board. And it's the owner board's responsibility to decide who manages the business, what policies that you follow, and reviews the financial performance of the business. So it may be the same people, but up here, they're wearing their owner hat. Here, they're wearing a manager hat. Here, they're running management segments of the business. When that's clear, we have a foundation for who is in charge of what, but we also have a basis for discussion. If dad goes, I want to retire, but I'm still going to be an owner, where do I go? Well, you become board chairman, and one of these guys may come up, or they may all say, I hate your job, you need to hire somebody from the outside. But we have a foundation for a discussion. And this lack of this picture is at the root of many of our succession problems. So let's close this with just a couple points here. Many people's first reaction to the word SOP is bureaucracy. We're going to create robots, right? I don't want to stifle creativity and innovation. How do we do something that's designed to provide more efficiency and innovation, but not stifle innovation? So we look at how do we reward good things, how do we develop bonuses, how do we do the positive things. I had a potato grower who had a huge 200 employees where they were very committed to safety, but they couldn't get them to show up for safety meetings. So they decided one year, we're going to throw a dinner, a chicken and potatoes dinner, for the employees and their families. We're going to set up stations around the room on different aspects of safety with little stickers, and everybody that comes to this meeting and gets all the stickers on their little card gets a free dinner and a $50 bill. 200 employees, what do you think their attendance was at that dinner? 100%. So they spent how much? $1,000. How quick do you think they got that $1,000 back in safety practices and a feeling of positive nature from their employees about their commitment to their employees? Pretty cheap bonus, right? So some of this stuff that may appear to be negative or offensive is actually very positive if you set it and frame it with some of these techniques. So where do we start? We need to look at having an in-house process improvement coordinator, look at kinds of legislation and requirements that would apply to you, look at your peers that have already done this, find ways to copy what they've done. Consider having an audit once in a while and just checking where you are as a business. And put them in places where your staff can find them and use them. So to summarize everything we've talked about today, you're in a business with lots of moving parts. We've got to excel at process mapping and costing. We as managers need to figure out how to create a 100% buy-in to a culture where we're proactive, that we need somebody clearly on board to be leading this stuff. And checking the box is not the same as living it. So as you pointed out over here, you can't have a cell phone policy unless it's got top-down commitment and practice from top down. So I'm going to wrap that up. There's additional resources in the guidebook I produced several years ago on how to do a lot of this. Now, do we have a few minutes for questions? Well, that wraps up what my formal, yes, sir. So his point is, he came from an aviation industry where there's so much SOPs that's all people do is they become robots. So an SOP is not a replacement for training. It's not a replacement for hiring people that are skilled and competent in the jobs. So if you take the premise that I'm going to hire quality people that have good skills and I'm going to train them, some of what they get can be founded on the SOP, but you don't want to have every single move to the point where you tell them how to get up in the morning and go to bed, right? I think that's your point. So I doubt that most of you will have the aviation 6-inch thick SOP manual. But would you all agree it'd be nice to have a checklist to put in the service truck? Just as a simple reminder, that's pretty simple, okay? Yes?
Dick, what's your thoughts on using videos for SOPs?
It's a great tool. The dairy industry, where it's hired a huge amount of Hispanics, where there's language situations, has used this very creatively. People in the service and mechanics industry are using this amazingly. They'll actually video a very complex thing and they'll narrate it as they're doing it, put it on a YouTube. We have mechanics where we will use videos to explain a problem, send it to them. They'll video a fix instead of charging $90 an hour to drive for 2 hours. We've been able to elevate and increase efficiency. It's incredible how videos. They're usually not really cool, they're not professional, but in a hot part of a day and you're trying to get going, the trade-off is great. Office management functions, we use CenterPoint software, and it's incredible how efficient it is. They have these videos where they've videoed somebody sitting at their computer doing something that you do over and over again, where you can just look at it and go, okay, I got it. It's a lot better than reading a manual and then trying to interpret what the person looked like sitting at a keyboard. So I would bet many of you with your smartphones could make very professional videos of some SOPs, and you could walk around a room and show maybe a complex procedure that you want to have replicated and just video it and say, okay, every time you do this, he's got some really complex openers. He could do a video on how to fix them. He does. He has them. Well, I'll be around all day, so I want to be respectful of time, and thank you for your attendance today.
Dick will be speaking again at the general session. He's the legacy sponsor lecturer here.